Welcome back, startup crew. Guess what? You made it into stage two of the 13 stages. Stage two is all about financing, loans, banks. Because listen, if you don't have money, well, you kind of don't get to have a startup. So today, we're going to blow your mind with the intricacies of funding. We're going to detail out the needs for associate dentists that can lead them into a startup. And you will be surprised at how many layers are really here. And you're going to be fascinated by the expert who I bring on for this discussion, who has now helped get $500 million in dental funding. That's right, $500 million in funding for dentists. So your mindset is going to go to a whole new level today in stage two, specifically for funding of dental startups. Here we go.
This is the Startup Dentist Podcast, where associate dentists ignite their journey to practice ownership with a startup that matters. Learn from the experts who have opened more private practice startups than anyone in dentistry, led by your host and CEO of Ideal Practices, Jamie Amos.
Welcome back to the Startup Dentist Masterclass. Jamie Amos here with a very special returning guest I have with me, the president of Ideal Practices, Mr. Stephen Treader. Stephen, would you say hello?
Hello, Masterclass. Hello, associates out there. Jamie, great to be here. Great to hear you.
I can't wait for this conversation because, guys, just so you know, Stephen has shared this wisdom about dental financing, about insider banking information to the tune of $500 million of funding in dentistry. That's a lot of money, which means that many loans have passed through his fingers or across his desk. And there's a lot you can learn from somebody who's done something that many times. So I would like to roll out here, Stephen and I, for the masterclass, we decided to put together a 6-part discussion just for you. So you can just really soak in all the information and you can learn this just like the masterclass that this is. Now, because we're going to cover a lot of ground, here's what you're going to find. You'll find this financing discussion broken into 2 parts. So here today, we're going to start with part one, which is going to be the structure of dental financing specific to startups. So structure is part one. In part two, we're going to talk about strategy. So there is structure for your dental financing, and there will be strategy. Strategy will be in part two. At the conclusion of this, we'll give you some ideas for that. Now, above everything else, remember that this is stage two of the 13 stages process. So Stephen, before I go much further, do you mind rattling off the 6 chapters that we're going to talk through over these 2 parts, and then we can dive?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to divide this up in 6 parts, like Jamie said. And I think as we started going, we're like, oh, wait a minute, we got to do that too. So we're able to break this down into really big, like 6 big nuggets here. So first one is rate and term. And really what we want to talk about there is, well, breaking the myth of not just chasing the rate. So rate and term is number one. Number two is the approval myth, which means I got the bank loan, therefore this is a great idea. So I want to break that is in terms of the approval myth. Number three is what we refer to as the silver platter method. This is the method that we've guided each one of our clients through the process of getting funding. In part two, now we're going to start talking about ranking banks. How do we rank them? What are we looking for in terms of lenders specifically? Part two there, the next part is going to be your personal strategy, being prepared. What is your personal strategy and how to prepare in order to obtain the necessary funding? And specifically kind of talking about there, addressing the student loans, especially that are hanging out there for many of you on our podcast today. And then last but not least is this question comes up so much, which is home or practice? What do I do first? And what do I do second? So those are 6 parts.
Excellent. So that, guys, it's going to be an incredible couple of discussions here. let's dig right in with rate and term. What's the one of the biggest questions that we get all the time? And doctor, if you're listening to this, you've probably asked yourself, what's the best rate and what's the best term for a startup? We're actually going to answer that question here. And some of the bankers out in dental land, they actually might not really like that we're about to just give you the cold, hard truth on some of these topics, but we're going to because you need to know. So the best rate and term for startups. Stephen, let's start there. I would love to have you take us down that path. Rate and term.
Yeah, rate and term. Well, I would love to say after over $500 million in loans and 15 years of doing this, I would say, what is the best rate and term? Well, it doesn't really exist. And what I mean by that is, yes, rate is important, and it's going to be a criteria. And here's the thing, rates fluctuate based upon market conditions, and terms may, you know, in different market conditions will also fluctuate. But for you listening, it's not about saying, hey, bank, what's your best rate? Because sometimes the best rate may actually get you in a position that you actually have actually not the best funding solution. And you're probably thinking to yourself, what do you mean by that, Stephen? Well, what we need to be able to identify really is looking at this from a cash flow perspective. So while interest rate is going to be one of the criteria that you would probably want to look at, it can't be your number one choice or your number one criteria of choosing the right funding. Because in some cases, you may get for example, I got a great rate on a short-term loan, but then now you're forcing yourself into a higher payment, which then constricts cash flow.
Such a good point. Actually,
cash flow is everything.
Cash flow is everything. Stephen and I, at our course, we will communicate very clearly. Stephen, you and I have both chanted this. Cash flow, the old statement is cash flow is king, right? Cash flow is king. Everybody says, especially in the small business world, a small business entrepreneurs say cash flow is king. Well, I want to assure you, cash flow is not king. It's actually much more grand than that. Cash flow is the entire kingdom. It's everything. It's not just king. It's the entire kingdom. Without cash flow, you literally go out of business. Like, cash flow means you have money left over to pay stuff, to pay yourself, to pay your team, to pay your light bills. It's called cash flow. No cash flow, no business. Now, here's the interesting thing that I have found all across the country is associate dentists will try to compare interest rates. Stephen, you've seen this. I mean, online, we see it all the time, right? Yeah. Like, well, I got a 3-something, or I got a 4-something, or I got a 2-something. Yep. So here's the problem. Let's pretend, Stephen, I know we've seen something like this happen. Mm-hmm. Let's pretend a dentist out there is like thumping their chest and trying to give themselves bragging rights on social media saying, I got the best rate in the country. I got the lowest rate ever. So they're really proud about the super low interest rate. But as a trade-off to that interest rate, let's pretend that doctor's payments are $12,000 per month. Now, if you work out the math, it's reasonably possible to say that your monthly payment can be 12 grand a month just for your loan, not anything else, because you have this trade-off. You could have the best rate in the world, but at 12 grand a month, well, guess what? You're toast. You won't last long. Why? Because you won't have cash flow. So the goal can't be interest rate, that you go chasing interest rate and you could end up with something really messy, because banking loan documents, if it was that simple, if all you really needed to know was the interest rate, Stephen, how long are typical banking documents these days?
The documents themselves are multiple pages. So, I mean, you're talking
like 15 to 20
of the fine print, you know, at like 6 font. So yeah, you spread that
fine
out.
Fine print, 6 yes. font, 15 yes. to 20 pages.
Do okay, I need to have banking... this reviewed? Yeah, okay, yeah. Get your magnifying glass, everybody, and you're going to read banking documents at really, really small font.
So if it were really as simple as just the interest rate, which is, all people who haven't applied for $500,000, you know, $500,000 for a loan, perhaps, in dentistry, for a startup practice, you go apply for $500,000 loan, not too many times in your life. But if it were as simple as just an interest rate, your loan documents would only need to be one page. It'd be one page. It'd have 3 numbers on it. It'd say X point X X percent, the end, sign here. If it were that simple, but obviously it's not. There's 15, 20 other pages at 6-point font, which is funny. So Stephen, rate and term, if we're going to transition away from rate and term, and we're going to focus on cash flow instead. What are some of the topics inside that discussion that people should start thinking through?
Well, when you're looking at cash flow, basically what is cash flow? Cash flow is really the difference between what goes in and what comes out. And so you got to make that gap bigger. In other words, revenue comes in, payments go out. So that cash flow is what gives you the ability to continue to grow your practice. So while it feels great in a lot of cases, be like, wow, if I can pay off my loan really, really fast, then I'll have the ability of having less risk. Well, no, you actually can actually create more risk and more stress by having the wrong structure of that loan. So having a repayment structure that just mirrors what your growth pattern is going to be and having something that gives you more manageability, kind of foreshadowing, kind of like with your student loans, like the more manageable the payment for your practice and the more manageable payment you have for your student loans, the less financial stress you're going to have. And as you grow in a business and grow in your practice is a business, you are all opening a business, not just a dental practice. In business, having the ability of having greater cash flow gives you flexibility. It gives you flexibility of growth. It gives you areas that you can then invest better into. So imagine you got this really great rate on the short term. You get this big payment. Where are areas you're going to sacrifice? Well, you may end up sacrificing the areas like, oh, wow, that marketing, that's expensive. I wish I had the budget monthly to do that. Well, now you don't have patience coming through. But congratulations, you've got a great interest rate on a short-term loan. You just can't market your practice now and actually get patients through the door. So you have to look at this from, what is my repayment option? What is the term on that? Also understand, what are the conditions attached to that? Are you signing on behalf of your parents, or do you have to have co-signers, or do you have houses? Do you have to have like different criteria or collateral for the loan? If you start getting into, wow, I got this great interest rate, but I got to put up a lot of money in order to do it, or a big down payment, or I got to add additional collateral, or heaven forbid, you got to have co-signers to it, that is not a great solution. You got to aim towards funding solutions. And the longer the period of time, I look at this and say, you're creating cash flow that gives you the ability as you grow, you're going to bring on more team members. Your payroll is going to go up. You want to be able to market, make sure you can free up that capital. So having that cash flow helps you actually grow. The other thing I also look for, Jamie, is what is the funding amount? Now, everyone could say, I got my practice open up for $200,000, or I got my practice open up for $300,000. I'm not saying that opening up a practice for $200,000 or $300,000 isn't a great solution. That sounds awesome. And I'm not sitting here today saying, hey, the biggest, you need to spend more. What I'm trying to explain is spend in the proper categories. Does that mean a $500,000 startup? Great. In some markets, it may be $600,000 or $700,000. It's making sure that you structure it properly. We don't have the biggest, what I'm not saying spend more equals better, but I'm also not saying spending less means that you're going to be more successful by spending the least amount on your startup. So for example, if you have the ability of like marketing and having a bigger marketing budget in order to get patients through the door, spend there. But if you say, well, I can sacrifice and not have the tile, the fancy travertine tile flowing in from Italy, okay, that's a good choice too in terms of spending on from a budget perspective. But you have to look at loan amounts and not just look at it and say, this is the loan amount, because sometimes getting a larger approval gives you the flexibility in order to spend properly in the categories for technology, for your marketing. And that will give you a better financial cushion than trying to like cut every corner and spend the least amount, where you only find yourself in a position like, wow, I wish I had more capital in order to invest in my practice, in order to grow my practice. So sometimes more capital gives you more flexibility. It lowers your stress, and it gives you the ability of actually investing into your practice on a long-term basis. And it also gives you a better cash flow cushion. That's my recommended path.
Really, really good. I actually love pointing to, there's a company out there that has more cash on hand than most countries. Like you may have heard of this company before. So it's a company that has more cashola, more cash, more dollars in their bank account than most countries, and they still have debt. The name of the company is Apple. So Apple Computers has more cash on hand than most countries and still takes out loans. They still have debt. The point that I'm making here is debt can be good business. Less debt is not an inherent good. I'll say it again. Less debt is not an inherent good. Proper amount of debt for your goals, that is where the good comes from. So not just about low rates. Stephen, love that. Not just, we need to make sure that the term is balanced for the goals of the practice. And certainly not just less debt in general, because less debt in general is not the goal either. Like you said, I love the idea of not having enough money for marketing, which, my gosh, you hear that from people. Like,
yes.
I'm out of money. I just opened my doors.
Yes. Oh, crap.
Now what? Like, you should have.
I forgot.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I know, everybody knows. I got equipment. I got construction. And then you get to the point, you kind of, and all of a sudden you're not monitoring the budget and you're not looking over your budget very well. And the bank goes, you get to the end and go, hey bank, so what's my marketing budget? Oh,
You spent it.
Ooh, mm-hmm. Whoa. Now you have a huge problem,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't properly spend. Mm-hmm. But you got your doors open for 400, 300,000 or half the amount or whatever the dollar amount is. It can't be, like you said, it can't be less debt is not the goal. Like you said, it's properly spending to get open successfully. And in some cases, that may mean a bigger, larger financial cushion, especially in for growth. That actually helps fuel growth for your business as well, is having that additional financial cushion.
Brilliant. Let me take you guys through some quick math in masterclass style. I'm going to be giving you some numbers here for a strategy to afford your startup practice. I want to teach you right now. If you're driving, try to conceptualize these numbers in your mind. If you're listening on a treadmill, I encourage you to just take a minute to pause and grab yourself a pen and paper, because I'm going to share some numbers with you that we've only taught in public a couple times. We teach at our course frequently, but I just want to spell out all the numbers here for you and then give you a resource to review the information. So ready, get a pen and pencil, and it's this. Write down at the top, if you would, 6 crowns. Six crowns. I'd like to share with you how to afford a startup practice as long as you can produce 6 crowns per month. So if you're an associate dentist, you're probably thinking, wait, 6 crowns a month? I could probably do 6 crowns in a day if I had to, right? Okay, so bear with me here. 6 crowns per month. Hang with me, right? You wrote down 6 crowns at the top of the page. On the left side of the page, I want you to write the word 6 crowns again. So write down 6 crowns on the left. And the number 500 on the right. So 6 crowns on the left, 500 on the right. Underneath 6 crowns, I'd like you to write down the number 700. So 6 crowns on the left, I'd like you to write down 700. Why 700? Well, the average reimbursement rate from an insurance company across the country is about $700. So now it's actually a little higher than 700, but I want to be really conservative here. You'll see with all of our numbers, all of our forecasting, all of our financial models, we are ridiculously conservative. So $700 per crown. Let's multiply these. 6 crowns per month multiplied by $700 equals, if you want to write this down underneath it, simple math equation, $4,200. Okay. So $4,200 on the left side of your page. Now let's go over to the right side of the page. On the right side of the page, we have the number 500 up at the top. Now, if you're like, you know, some people are numbers people, simple people are not, I want to give you a visual of this so that you, if you're anything like my wife, an amazing person, my best friend, one of the smartest, most talented, most wise people I know, if I shared these numbers with her, her eyes would glaze over and she'd probably pass out. She'd be like, what? Like, this is boring. Help me, like, just take care of people. I don't like numbers. Okay, cool. If you're one of those I don't like numbers people, go to our YouTube channel, because we created a video for this that teaches 6 crowns per month as a visual aid. You can go to YouTube, look for Ideal Practices. That's the name of our consulting firm, right? Go to YouTube, Ideal Practices, and you can see the 6 crowns per month video representation. On the right-hand side of this page, ready? We got 500 on the top. This 500 represents a $500,000 loan. So 500 representing, let's just call it 500K, right? 500K, $500,000. Now, a $500,000 loan, if you write underneath that 500K, write down the number 15. This 15 represents years, the number of years to repay the loan. So $500,000 loan, repaid over 15 years at a 5% interest rate. You'll get a better interest rate than that, I would assume. We'll see. We'll see what's right for you. But let's just pretend conservatively it's 5%. So 500K, 15 years, 5%. The payment on a traditional amortized loan is, ready? Write this number down. This one's important. $3,953.97. So $3,953.97. Okay. You should have on the bottom of your page now, the bottom of the page should have two numbers, 4,200. And on the right side of the page, you should have the number 3,953. So here's what's interesting. This shows in very simple math that you can afford the payment on a $500,000 loan. Perhaps that could be yours for your startup, $3,900. As long as you can produce 6 crowns per month. Now, I don't know about you, but every time I teach this at a course, there's almost like an audible sigh of relief at this point, because $500,000 of a loan for a startup, that sounds really overwhelming. Like, that's a lot of money. But when you can break it down this way and realize, mathematically speaking, you can afford a startup practice as long as you produce 6 crowns per month under these assumptions, then it can feel a little more approachable, right? Like, you nod your head with me if you're listening along. Like, nod your head, right? Yes, of course. This is a little more approachable. So here's what I want to convey to you right now. It's this. If you can afford a loan, a startup practice loan in just producing 6 crowns per month, now if you're an endodontist or an orthodontist or a pediatric dentist, we've helped all specialties, oral surgery, I mean, prosthodontist, everybody. We've helped all kinds of startups around the country. You get the idea with the math here, whether or not you're doing 6 crowns per month. You get the idea. Here's something I want to point out. Though you can afford a startup with 6 crowns per month, Stephen, what are we seeing now when our team negotiates with the banks? You know, every time we integrate this, we negotiate with the banks, we have these discussions. What are we seeing now in terms of monthly payment amounts on startup loans, ballpark average? What are we seeing?
Less than half, near, or in some cases, less than half of that. So we're hovering around, and depending on the dollar amount, what's borrowed, somewhere around a couple $1,000s, maybe around $2,000, $2,100. So nearly half. So in some cases, even less. Yeah. So $2,000 a month average.
Even with a non-negotiated loan, you could afford a startup practice by producing just 6 crowns a month. Can you, with your startup, do you think it's possible that you can produce 6 crowns a month? Now, here's the mind-blowing part. Inside this $500,000 loan, this is where most startups really go off the rails and have major financial problems. They forget that inside the $500,000 loan amount, you need to have everything built in. Everything. Now, when I say everything, I'm going to rattle off a couple of topics here, because these are things that need to be inside your financial budget planning. So ready? If you want to write these down, or if you just want to listen along, I'll rattle off a few that should really anchor in your mind. Maybe you even want to replay what I'm about to say. Inside your $500,000 budget, I'm not saying yours will be $500,000, but let's go under the assumption for this conversation, $500,000. Inside that budget, we need to include equipment, of course, right? We need your construction. So all of your equipment, all of your construction, all of your technology, right? All the, if you want 3D, if you want digital x-rays, all your technology. Next, we need marketing. So like Stephen pointed out, you need to pre-plan for your marketing. So we need all of your marketing budget, all of it built in to your budget. Next, we need payroll. Payroll? Yep, payroll. What do I mean? These are the paychecks. This is the money that you're going to use to pay the employees. You need this built into the 500K. Why? Well, guess what? The first Friday after you open your doors, like, yay, grand opening celebration on Monday. On Friday, guess who you need to pay? Well, the employees. Okay, that's normal. The employees want their paychecks on Friday. But guess who hasn't paid you yet? The insurance companies. Yeah, here's the thing. The reality is the insurance companies, they're going to pay you, but it might take 2 or maybe even 3 weeks in some cases. You're not going to get paid on the first Friday. But the employees, that's the deal. Like, you got to pay them on Friday. So you need payroll pre-planned, built in to your $500,000 budget. Hanging with me here? Like, you're probably seeing like, oh, right. Yeah, I got to pre-plan this. Ready for the next one? Legal fees. Like, legal fees to do the legal paperwork for things that we can talk about in other episodes. But legal fees need to be built in. CPA fees need to be built in. Consulting fees need to be built in. Yes, consulting fees. Just so you know, the consulting fees, banks who know dentistry, they actually pay for the consulting fees inside your loan. So you actually, through all the negotiations and the strategies, you can actually spend much less by working with a consultant, because the consultant typically saves you more than you would spend in the first place. Regardless, consulting fees should be built into the practice loan. Ready for the next one? Lease payments. So your payments to your landlord, your lease, your, let's just call it your rent. Your rent has to be built in. Why? Well, come the first of the month, ready? That first Friday, first of the month, rent is due. Uh-oh. But going right back to where we started before, the insurance companies may or may not pay you by that first Friday. So we need to pre-plan rent built in, right? Hanging with me? All right, I'll give you one more. This one's a bit of a head turner. So get yourself seated. This one gets people's heads spinning a little bit. Ready? In your $500,000 budget, you need to include your loan payment. What? Yeah, I'll say it again. In your $500,000 loan, you need to include at least your first loan payment. Jamie, are you, now I'm gonna talk about myself in the third person here for a second. I'm gonna pretend I'm you, doctor. I'm gonna pretend I'm you asking me a question. Jamie, are you saying that my loan should pay for my loan payment? Yep. Yes, I am. I am absolutely saying your loan in that first month should pay for your loan payment. Why? Well, same problem as the payroll, same problem as the rent. You're gonna have to make your loan payment. So we have to make sure that it's built into the budget so you can be very conservatively prepared financially. So that's the 6 crowns method. 6 crowns to afford a startup practice. As long as you produce 6 crowns a month, you can afford a startup. I hope that this conceptually helps you understand, okay, that's a little bit of how I build my budget. There's a little bit of how I approach the numbers to it. So Stephen, now we've got some budget. We've got some 500K strategy in there. We've got some 6 crowns. We discussed a little bit of Apple, how even Apple with all their cash, they know that loans can be a good thing. Any other thoughts there before we go to chapter two, our second topic?
No, I think it's about like making sure that you just don't stop there saying, ooh, I can afford this. It's making sure there's so many other strategies that go beyond just like, hey, I got the loan and I can afford that piece. So, yep.
Love it. Okay. Excellent. Then I love how you said the approval myth. I think I would venture to say that 90 to 95% of associate dentists out there who have attempted to open startups, they get a sense of validation, a sense of validation when the bank says, cool, here's a piece of paper that says you're approved, right? That's the approval. So what say you about the approval myth?
I think it's looking at this saying, hey, that banks equaling, I guess the myth is quite simply this, having the approval doesn't mean this is like the greatest idea ever, because it's the banks are qualifying based upon criteria that is simply like your own personal financial criteria. But the banks are going to lend and get you approved, but it doesn't mean like, hey, this is the best area. This is the best spot. All that other criteria is left out there. The banks are simply saying on paper, you are approved, but that doesn't mean like, yeah, go ahead.
Let me get this straight. So I'm pretty sure you're saying just because the bank slides you a letter that says approved, it doesn't mean the idea for your startup is a good one.
Exactly.
And it doesn't mean your location is good. And it doesn't mean your strategy is good. And it doesn't mean the conversation you had with the bank sales guy on the phone, it doesn't mean that conversation was good. Just because you get an approval letter doesn't mean your startup, I like your term, Stephen, does not equal success. An approval letter does not equal success. So Stephen, why is it that people like really desire to get to that stage of an approval letter? I mean, how much, you've been a part of lots and lots of lending. talk us through, like, how much is that piece of paper really worth? what's that approval paper worth?
It's worth very little. I mean, because you can get an approval from a lot of different banks, but the banks aren't looking through the criteria of, is this the right demographics? Do you have the right area that aligns best for your vision? Are the patients, is there enough ample patients here for your vision? They're not evaluating even like, hey, is this the right landlord or is this the right space? Again, like, it is a piece of paper that says financially, you meet the criteria of the bank to be approved. That's it. Based upon no other criteria other than what you've given to them as a financial statement. And do you meet their criteria on a spreadsheet from the bank that says, yep, you meet the guidelines, but they're not evaluating whether or not, like, everything else beyond what they do is going in, what you do in terms of your startup is meeting. There is no criteria. They're not evaluating any other criteria other than that.
So if they're not really looking at the business concept for the approval, right? They're not looking at the demographics. They're not looking at the landlord negotiations. They're not looking at your budget. Even if you get an approval letter and the bank hasn't even required those things. I mean, I even think to myself, like, what? Some banks tell startup dentists they don't need a business plan? Are you freaking kidding me? But anyway, that aside. So there's all these things that the bank is not requiring. If that's the reality, which it is, then what, bluntly speaking, let's be really blunt, what is the approval based on?
Just your financial information.
Personal financial and personal income, right?
That's it. There is no business criteria. Absolutely not.
Do you mind if I share the story of when we spoke at that bank and the stadium seating? You mind if I tell that story?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So get this. Stephen and I were invited to speak at one of the country's largest banks in dentistry. And we're standing there presenting to this really neat amphitheater style room. And the bank wanted to kind of learn the startup process and educate some of their employees, their team members on this concept of the startups that they'd seen work so well. So they flew us in, kind of wined us and dined us, and gave us a chance to kind of share our methods with them. So we're going through the presentation, and we're sharing the ideas about things that are working across the country. And as we're going through this discussion, like, heads are nodding, we're having a great discussion, it's really good, but there's these three people up in the top left corner. These three people, you know, at random times through the presentation, they would raise their hands. And I would, you know, politely pause and say, yeah, what's up? And they started, each time, they started asking questions like, questions that sounded like they were trying to fix failing startups. Kind of like, you know, if a startup's been open for a couple of years and they're still not profitable, what do you guys recommend? And they kept asking these kinds of questions, and it kind of got me a little embarrassed, because I those aren't the kinds of questions our clients ever ask us. I could give them some ideas, but those aren't really the things that we end up needing to deal with. And I tried to graciously answer as best as I could, but they kept asking questions about struggling startups. And about three quarters of the way through the conversation, I said, hey, could we pause for a second? I want to ask you a question. Great questions, thank you. But what part of the bank do you work for? These are really odd questions to come from a banker. Where do you work? What do you do here? And they said, oh, the three of us, we're from the special assets division. I looked at Stephen. I was like, am I supposed to know what that is? And so I said, what is that? So turns out the special assets division is the group in the bank that tries to swoop in and save failing startups. I'll repeat that. It's a designated group of people who work for the bank. Their full-time job is to swoop in and try to fix failing startups. Now, if you've ever heard from anybody that the failure rate of startups is low, you might want to talk to those guys up there in the stadium seating, the special assets division. Just the mere fact that the bank is willing to fund the payroll, like, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars of payroll to fix failing startups. Frankly, it gets me a little frustrated that banks sometimes tell young doctors, oh, don't you worry, the failure rate of startups is so low. Really? Well, then who are those three dudes up in the corner of the stadium seating? Who are they? And here's the irony of the whole thing. Special Assets Division, as an acronym, is SAD, spells the word sad. Like, wow, that's painfully ironic. So what I'm trying to point out is, listen, there are some very frustrating myths in dental funding. One of them is what I just described, that even banks know that they have clients who go down that path. I didn't even know that was a thing before this presentation, but now we know that there are banks that have this. And another one of the myths that get me frustrated is this approval myth. So Stephen, thank you for bringing that up. The approval myth, I want to shield people from feeling like it's time to celebrate or feeling like their idea is a good idea for their startup just because they were slipped a piece of paper that says approved.
Well, and if I add on to that, I would say, you know, what's out there a lot is there's this number equation where they say, you know, 1% or something like that. I always say, beware of that 1%, you know, language that's out there. And that percent is basically saying the banks will say,
what?
1% of practices fail.
Ah, yeah.
Yep. So in other words, it's like, well, wait a minute. So 99% of the people listening today are going to be successful? Yes. 99% of you will be successful. Oh, wait a minute. Here's the caveat. What that means is 99% of you will be able to pay your loans.
So 99% won't go bankrupt.
Right.
Right. How's that for a benchmark?
Yay. Right. That's the benchmark. It's whether or not you can pay the loan. It doesn't say how many startups, you probably heard of these startups that struggle, but continue to pay their loan as agreed, but still have to work as an associate 2, 3, 4 years after they've actually opened their own practice. Don't be that statistic.
That right? Those guys are baked into that 99%. You could be working with your special assets division, if you know what I mean, just so that they can lump you into the 99%.
Yes.
So the low failure rate simply means, Stephen, that's awesome. So I think what you're saying is the low failure rate means that that's how many go bankrupt, close their doors, and have complete and utter financial catastrophe.
Yes. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Ouch. Yep. Ouch.
Yep.
All right, let's talk through the third topic here. So for today, in part one of our financing discussion, remember, we're breaking this up into two sections. So the next three chapters of our discussion will be in part two here in just a little while. I'm really excited to get into the third discussion point, which is the silver platter. This is a near and dear spot to my heart because I know it has done a great job for hundreds of doctors all around the country, the silver platter concept. So Stephen, mind walking us through what people should know here?
Yeah, to understand the silver platter method is putting yourself in the right position, almost like you're on a silver platter to be able to get the proper funding from lenders. It's being prepared. It's preparing yourself. And one of the big things in here is what's inside of your business plan. Now, Jamie even mentioned, you know, some banks may not require a business plan. Everybody, you are opening a business. You are starting a business. Without a plan, then you don't have a business. So you need to have a business plan. The other thing you need to understand in there is what is your own personal financial statement look like? Before you start shooting from the hip and saying, hey, banks, I'm going to apply to you, where are you at financially? Have you taken a review of your own financial statement? Do you have the right proper financial preparation to actually apply for loans? In other words, do you have enough money set aside? Do you have enough of the criteria from a financial perspective, liquid assets and things like that, that you're ready to go talk to banks and lenders? And last but not least, I call it the underwriting preparation. Before you start talking to underwriters, you need to be prepared to answer those questions. What are they going to be looking for? They're going to have questions to you. How are you going to answer those? You need to be properly prepared for those. So those are the three elements: underwriting preparation, understanding your financial statement, ensure that you're financially in the right position to obtain the funding before you start talking to banks, and your business plan and what goes into it.
Mind if I pepper you with questions on each of those? Can I try to pry open the lid a little bit?
Pry it open.
All right. So underwriting preparation. Mm-hmm. As number one here. I was actually taking some notes myself. Underwriting preparation. What are some of the maybe stumbling blocks? Underwriter preparation, having a discussion with the banking person. So there's the banking salesperson, sales guy, sales gal, yep, who is the person who calls themselves the banker, who gets to sign the initial paperwork. And then there's actually somebody else who decides if you're going to get the loan. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the underwriter.
Yes.
How would you describe an underwriter? And then what are some of the twists and turns to prepare for an underwriter that surprised a lot of associate dentists?
Now, I have friends that are still in underwriting. So for those, hopefully they're not listening. But underwriters are kind of like the people that, like, you're declined until you prove that you can be approved. So you're declined first because banks naturally don't want to lend. Well, they do and they don't. The reason why they don't want to is that the more debt that is out there, the more debt they have to collect. So underwriters are protecting the assets of the bank. And many of them are actually kind of compensated based upon writing good approvals, not taking risk. They are not, they are risk inherent. Naturally, people, that's who they are. Like, I am looking out for the best interest of the bank. So being prepared to underwriters means understanding what's in your own financial statement. What do you have in the bank? What are your assets? Be able to talk to those assets. They'll ask you questions about what you're doing in your current associate position. So understanding, what do you produce right now as an associate? What do you collect as an associate? Being able to answer those questions from a financial perspective doesn't mean go through and rifle through all the financial information in your own practice. Now, if you have easy access to that, great. But having a general understanding of what you produce and what that is and what that equates to. One of the questions that gets hung up a lot of times is, it sounds like a really innocent question, but it can actually have a profound effect. The question is, sometimes they'll ask the question, do you plan on keeping your associate position? Now, many of you will probably think about it and say, well, I don't plan on it because I'm opening up my own practice. But the simple answer to that needs to be, in most cases, is yes, I plan on. Now, here's why. Most banks are going to factor in certain things into your financial, like their big formula. And many of them will require that you keep an associate position. Now, you may say innocently, I don't plan on it because, and you usually, in the follow-up usually is, I don't plan on it because I'm going to work my practice and I'm going to get this open. What the underwriter heard, oh, they're quitting tomorrow. They're quitting their associate position tomorrow. Now we have a loss of that backup income in order to make our approval. Even though innocently you just said no to a question because you thought, wait a minute, I don't plan on working, but I know if I have to, I want to keep that outside income until a point where my startup replaces my income. So don't get hung up on that, but be prepared to be able to explain to an underwriter, I plan on working until my startup replaces that income. That answers that question more properly.
Got any like knee-jerk reactions to shocking stories or maybe a client story? I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but any client stories where you're like, oh my gosh, so glad they dodged that bullet. That's one that I know would have capsized their ship on this journey. What's the idea of that?
Well, I'll say I can think of an example where recently we had a couple of clients there was going to be a couple partners. And even though that's a whole nother discussion for later for a different podcast. We talk about partnerships, but this was a partnership that actually was going to work really, really well. The challenge was they were actually in different states where they're going to be moving. So before we actually had our clients apply, we actually had calls with the clients to explain to them how they're actually going to talk to the underwriters and explain the logistics of who's going to work, who's applying, and who's actually going to be the owners of this practice. Because again, we had a couple different kind of very unique scenarios of like who was a citizen, who was going to be in the practice, who was going to do this. And if it wasn't for our team's preparation with the clients to have those conversations, literally the salesperson from the bank called us to say, if it wasn't, I think it was something like this. They knew how to answer the questions. They were prepared to answer the questions. And the salesperson said, if the clients were not prepped, they would not have had the approval because the clients knew how to answer the questions. And they almost knew the questions that were coming before. So there was no cheat sheet. No one rifled through, you know, like you see on like those television, the TV shows, like the kids dug through the trash and found the answer key. Well, we kind of had the answer key because we knew the questions that underwriters typically will ask. And because of a unique scenario, we kind of had the answer key in order for our clients to rehearse that before they actually talked with the underwriter. It was awesome.
Love that. I love how you and the consultants on your team, I've heard them describe before things like the underwriters, they can't unhear it. When you say to an underwriter, literally goes to the file, right? You say it, they don't unhear those words. Mm-hmm. I've also heard you guys talk through this being a little bit like a judge and jury trial. How do you describe that to clients?
Well, I describe it as a couple things. Is imagine like you're watching one of those television shows or like one of those movies where they kind of like they prep the person before they go, the witness before they go before the stand, before the judge and jury. Now, keep in mind, nobody's here going on judge and jury. You're not going to jail if you answer something or you say anything wrong to an underwriter. But it kind of has the effect of like I'm going before the judge and jury, and it's that rehearsal of how they're going to answer those questions when they get up on the stand. And there's also the element of answering the question without having to elaborate too much of the answer. Does that make sense? In other words, ask a question that's a yes or no answer, answer it with a simple yes or no. Don't go too far down a rabbit hole of explaining too many things, because then you may open up all these other avenues that then the underwriter goes, oh, cool, other avenues I can ask a whole nother set of questions. And now all of a sudden they find something that they don't like because it was like this whole other path that you went down. Answer the simple questions, give the answers, move on to the next question.
Oh, that's good. So good. All right. They're really awesome. Anything else on underwriters before we go into financial statement?
No. Let's go. Okay.
What are some recommendations and some highlights that associate dentists should be thinking through related to the silver platter strategy, specifically with this financial statement topic?
Well, I think it's understanding what's in your financial statement. And number one, like you know, we always prep our clients. We actually get a financial statement from each one of our clients before we actually approach banks. That's one of the initial things we always do with our clients. But also, it's also a good understanding of what do you have on cash on hand? Because what banks are going to be looking for in today's environment is they would much rather you have, don't think that no debt is the path or the solution to getting funding. It's not. Like Jamie, you talked about it. Like, wait a minute. So Apple has all this cash, but they still borrow money. Yes. Getting out of debt is not your goal of getting funding. It's actually having cash reserves, having liquidity, having a certain amount of liquid assets. That's where banks are getting to feel more comfortable. It's not about having no debt and no cash. It's actually having both. You're going to have a better path of getting a funding approval if you have some debt and cash on hand, because that cash on hand is the rainy day fund. It's the fund that the banks go, you are having good character. You have good credit. You're operating good character. You're saving money. You're not spending everything. That is I've actually had clients that have had $400,000 or $450,000 in student loans that still have cash on hand get approved. And I've seen people that have struggled where they have hardly any student loans or very little debt, but they didn't save anything. I'll tell you, cash and liquidity, not just cash, but I'm saying liquid assets is the criteria that you want to have. And typically, most banks are going to be looking at somewhere between 5% and about 10% of the loan amount that you would want to have in liquid assets. That will put you in the best financial position to get you properly funded.
Really good. And this is, guys, this is, as you're listening through this, you may have seen at some point some of our teaching about why you should not pay down your dental school debt. Now, I've gotten a lot of heat for this, but I'm still right. Our team is correct in describing that you should not pay down your dental school debt if you desire to become a practice owner soon. Now, what I'm not saying is don't make your minimum payments. You got to make your minimum payments or you're going to blow up your credit. Your credit score will be ruined. You have very few options at your fingertips. You got to make your minimum payments. But the goal touted by people like, let's say, Dave Ramsey, ton of respect for Dave Ramsey, brilliant with financial guidance for personal finance. I'll say it again, personal finance, not business finance. Personal finance, he says, pay down your debt. He's got the snowball effect. If you've never heard of Dave Ramsey, he's got some good content for personal finance. But for business finance, this is a business loan. This is a business decision with your school debt. Don't pay down your school debt because imagine the trade-off. Imagine you pay down a ton of school debt. You feel like a champ because you're like, hey, I have hardly any school debt, but you're cash empty. Your bank account has just a couple bucks left in it, but you're like, I'm amazing because I have no school debt. Unfortunately, you've just spent the last few years sucking all the cash out of your life, paying down your school debt. And Stephen, if you're that associate dentist and you're like, yeah, I've only got $15,000 left of school debt and I have not a dollar to my name, how likely is it that that doctor is going to get approved for a $500,000 loan?
Highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely. Super safe answer. I like that. highly unlikely. Because listen, the goal is not to get rid of your debt. The goal is, like we've been talking about from the very beginning, the goal is cash flow. Cash flow is the entire kingdom. When it comes to financing, it's not about paying down your school debt. When it comes to financing, it's not just about rate and term. When it comes to financing, it's not about getting this weird, magical, mythical approval letter. That's not the goal. The goal is cash flow. And you need the strategy to be reverse engineered, all pre-planned, pre-planning, reverse engineered, built for your custom situation. When you hear people online be like, hey, can I just borrow your business plan? I want to copy paste. And then I'll have a business plan too. For the love of God, don't. Like, your business plan needs to be customized for you. So Stephen, how's that for a segue? Let's talk through business plans, reverse engineering the whole strategy. What say you on that topic? I don't know how much you want to reveal there, but go ahead, business plans. What say you?
I would like to reveal a little bit on business plans in that you need to have a plan in order to tell the bank where you want to go. Because while some banks may say, oh, we don't require one, nearly every bank is going to require a business plan. And again, you are a business. What is your plan? So, Jamie, I would love to be able to, like, I like this is something we only talk about, I only discuss, like, at one of our events. But I would love to share with the listeners today the five main criteria or the five factors that need to be in every business plan.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, you can Google a business plan, but you can spend hundreds of hours going down rabbit trails. Yeah, you mind just sharing, like, actually what we just taught at our last 2-day course?
Absolutely. I got a business plan today for one of our teams. So I've got one in cool. front of me, and I would love to be able to tell you, like, hey, this is what goes into it. So here are five things.
All right.
So if you're listening
bearing all here, guys. We're bearing all. Ready?
Here we go. Here are the five things you need to have in a business plan. Number one is your vision and your executive summary. Who are you? Where are you going? What are the things that tell the story about who you are? What have you accomplished? What are you going to accomplish with the startup? Tell the banks what your story is, your personal story, your clinical story, what you've accomplished as an associate, and what are your goals and what you're going to accomplish, and what is this practice going to stand for, and what is the purpose of this practice. So that's your vision and your executive summary. Who are you? Number two, the demographics. The demographics will tell the information about who is there, who are you going to serve. There's a whole, we'll go down a whole deep topic on the of demographics, but you need to tell the bank the highlights of the opportunity of why you want to go here, why does it align, what is the statistical opportunity, but also who is there from a demographical perspective and how does it align for the future success of your practice. That's number two. Number three, the marketing strategy. Wait a minute, I got to have a marketing strategy? Yes. There's lots of things out there like tactics. We'll talk more and deeper later in the series about marketing strategies. But you got to tell the banks, how are you going to get patients? Not just how are you going to spend the money, but how are you going to get patients through the door? So that's number three, your marketing strategy. Number four, your budget.
So the bank is going to say, oh, we're willing to give you money, but where are you going to spend it? And how are you going to spend it? You want to have a detailed budget of the areas in which, how are you going to spend? Where are you going to carve off certain things? Where are you going to spend in equipment, construction? There's a whole list. I mean, Jamie, we have a budgeting tool of like so many different criteria that we go through that breaks down the budget. You got to be able to tell bank where you're going to spend those funds. That's number four. And last but not least, number five is projections. What is your projected income? What is your projected collections? What are your projected expenses? Like, they are projections. And yes, they are scientific darts that you are going to throw on this board of like where you are projecting. And yes, they are sometimes darts, but you need to be able to explain to the bank, because some banks be looking and go, awesome, how are you making money? Where are your expenses? And what are you going to have left over in order to make sure that we can all be paid? Do you have an understanding of how to make those projections? That's something that we have to build for each one of our clients to be able to tell the bank, this is what it's going to look like. And we're always very conservative, but you need to have an understanding of, wow, if I collect X after everything's paid out, what comes out? What's left over? So you need to have projections in there. So those are your five criteria.
And I love that. Thank you for being so raw. Guys, I hope this is like real solid consumable content that you can go back and rewind and write down and start to assemble, because these are the kinds of moments when we get feedback from doctors who just feel so empowered. I mean, when you imagine looking at those numbers with that specificity, knowing that they're hyper-customized for your town, hyper-customized just for your model. And I'm not just talking about if you're a specialist or a general dentist, I'm talking about for your model, not your practice, but your model, your business model, how you're going to serve your community, the growth rate that you want to experience, the funding and the marketing strategies that you want to use months before, the ones you build out months before your opening day, all those concepts baked into equations that are customized for you. How many people will you have hired? How much will your supply bill be? What will your lab bill look like? All those criteria go into the projections. Now, like Stephen said, they're projections, not promises, but they're valid. They're legitimate, focused points based on a customized reality called your startup. This is yours, not somebody else from some other town with some other ideal patient, with some other demographic, with a different climate, different temperature, different ideal patient, different funding, different financial strategy, different goals, different life, different specialty. Like, a business plan is not just a couple pieces of paper. It's a customized plan for your business. So thank you for being so raw, Stephen. Really good. Any final remarks here before we conclude part one?
No, we'll have a lot more coming up in part two. Can't wait to dig into that. That's going to be some of the strategies on some of the personal strategies you can also do as well. So can't wait for part two.
Personal strategies, student loans, and buying a house, and ranking some banks. We're going to have a great discussion to go even deeper into the financing topic so you can be fully prepared to have a startup that matters. We're going to do this. It's going to be great. Cannot wait to be back with you in just a few minutes in part two of financing. Take care.
Join us in the startup crew. This is our private Facebook group dedicated just to associate dentists. In this community, we carry conversations from the podcast into real life, and you get to interact with me and the other experts to consider your future in private practice ownership. Join me in the startup crew. Here's how to get there. Go to startupdentistpodcast.com. You can find the link to access the group there, or go to Facebook and search for Startup Crew. I'll see you inside the Startup Crew community. Take care.